So this panel, the idea to have a historian, environmental historian, address environmental journalists, emerged from a conversation last spring at the annual conference of the American Society of Environmental History, or ASEH. Check out us and our journal at aseh.net. And we had a plenary session with environmental journalists last April in St. Paul. It was April 1st, was April Fool's Day. And we all agreed that it would be great to continue nourishing conversations between environmental journalists and environmental historians. And Mark said something at the panel like, so if there are any environmental historians in Vermont, come to the conference next fall, and that's how this all got going. So many thanks to Mark and Jay and Nancy for inviting me in for the endless chain of emails we exchanged all year long, making this happen. I'm grateful for the opportunity to speak here. And I'd also like to acknowledge a couple of advisors and mentors, one of whom is here, Bill McKibben, who's a scholar in residence at Millbrae College and is ever supportive of the ES program and of my work. And also my own historical advisor and mentor, Bill Cronin, who teaches at the University of Washington, whose own work is the source of much of what I'm going to say today, certainly all the really smart parts of it. So why bring together historians and journalists? After all, there's some fairly significant differences between the two groups, between what you guys do and what we do. First of all, you write very, very quickly because you have to. We write extraordinarily slowly. You write about events as they actually happen. We write about events as long as possible after they really happen. In fact, my own work is on the Industrial Revolution, and I feel like we're just really beginning to start to get a final grip on 19th century industrialization and its transformation of nature. And, you know, I'm confident in our understanding of the past, maybe up to 1900 or so. But that doesn't mean we won't rework that understanding in the next couple generations. Anyway, but it's hard to imagine you guys coming up with your headline, Industrialization Transforms Nature. And of course, you write stories that people actually read. And we were pretty hard to write stories that are so long and so complex, 300 pages and up, with such emphasis on complexity that we somewhat ensure that few will read them. And we do have one thing in common, of course, which I want to talk to you about today, which is our shared desire and our passion to tell stories about human beings and nature. You tend to tell those stories about human beings and nature the present, and we tell them in the past. But we all go out into the world and search for good stories to tell. We ask questions, we seek answers to those questions, and we share the belief that the asking of the questions and the telling of the stories are the first and most necessary steps in the solving of environmental challenges. Difference, of course, our stories about the past, yours about the present, and the question of the day then becomes, what do our stories about the past offer to you as practitioners of environmental journalism? One more. How's that?
Every time you put your head down, your voice disappears.
Okay. Try that. How's that? So what do we offer? What can be useful about our stories? I take for granted that your stories are useful to me, and they are, because they prompt me to ask questions about the past, to go back into the past, to figure out how we got here, how we got to the world that you so ably describe. But what use are all these big fat books that are in the bookstore in the face of our present challenges? So I'll start with what historian stories are really not good for. We do not predict the future. We just don't. We don't like to, we don't even like to try to, we're pretty shaky in any sort of commentary on the present as well. We generally agree that we won't be getting any sort of firm sense of the present for a good half century at least, and then of course the classicists who write about Greece and Rome who think that you have to wait like centuries and centuries and centuries to get any real grasp on the events in question. We are also rather loath to draw lessons from the past and apply them to the present. The old saying from George Santayana, those who cannot learn from history are doomed to repeat it. Well, not precisely. Nothing ever happens this exact same way twice. History never repeats itself. Yet, as storytellers, we can take any series of events in the past and make them look like any other series of events in the past. We can make it look like history is repeating itself, and we can make it look like humans have failed to learn the lessons of the past, but that's actually one carefully constructed version of whatever story we're telling, usually constructed for the explicit purpose of fomenting some sort of lesson. So it doesn't always work to draw lessons from the past. History, after all, is not what happened in the past. It's a set of stories that human beings tell about what happened in the past. And human beings can take the same series of events and tell a quite wide range of very different stories about them. and draw very different lessons. So the past doesn't teach us lessons. We invent the lessons for ourselves, usually to suit the present. In general, for instance, Americans love historical analogies, which allow us to connect current events to the past through comparison. With Hurricane Katrina, everyone immediately likes to say, oh, this is just like X. This is analogous to the Mississippi River flood of 1927. Well, yes and no. It kind of depends on the narrative you accept of the Mississippi River flood of 1927. In fact, in the last few weeks and months, there are some pretty powerful analogies flying around the media world, the blogosphere, particularly that the violence in Baghdad is analogous to the Tet Offensive. But I heard a great commentator on NPR the other day point out exactly the problem with such analogies. Analogy is never simple. It's entirely open to interpretation. This commentator said that of course, the meaning of the analogy, this is like that, depends on your interpretation of that, depends on your historical narrative of the Tet Offensive of 1968, which can be given a broad range of meanings depending on what you're looking for in the past. So given that Tet's meaning is itself contested, then the analogy's meaning remains contested, full of multiple meanings, and hence, to some degree, meaningless. So too with all historical analogies. Humans, particularly Americans, rarely share a single vision of the past, of the Tet Offensive, of the Mississippi River Flood of 1927, that can be easily interpreted in the present or easily reduced to lessons. So we don't have lessons. What can we offer? What is history good for? Well, mostly explains how we got to where we are today. That's why the books are so fat. To explain the various messes of the moment, we insist on going all the way back to the beginning. Sometimes way, 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 way back. As one of my favorite historians, Elliot West, has written, our friends are always accusing us of being unable to comment on a changed traffic light without going back to the Magna Carta to start explaining. But can we be a bit more useful without forcing everyone to read the 300-page books? Are there broad trends, patterns, conclusions about American environmental history that emerge clearly from that giant stack of books, 300-page books? Yes, and those trends and patterns offer not any absolute lessons for the present or any firm predictions for the future, but they do offer some ideas about what may happen, perhaps what is likely to happen, based on the broadest sense of what's happened in the past. So I've composed a list of basics, and you're under no obligation to take notes, that indicates some of what we've concluded through a couple of generations of writing stories about the environmental past. First, all human history has an environmental context. Everything we think of as a historical topic, war, politics, culture, unfolded within an ecological framework, with both shaped and was shaped by human action and ideas of nature. So any topic you can think of, and you can test me on this later, somehow has an environmental history. I, in fact, managed to come up with one of a gold rush. Everything was shaped in some way by the physical world. In studying environmental change, second, it is best to assume that most human activities have environmental consequences. Seems like a no-brainer, I'm sure, but important to say. It's also best to assume that whatever human beings do in nature, we will never know in advance all the consequences of those actions. In fact, if we were to reduce all of American environmental history to two words, boil all of our knowledge and all of our study down to one simple formula, it would be unexpected consequences. More on that in a minute. In any historical situation, if human beings assume stability, a lack of change, either on the part of nature or on the part of culture, they are very likely to be mistaken. Neither nature nor culture is static. History, change over time, plays a crucial role in shaping the patterns and processes of ecosystems, of nature, whether or not people are involved, and of course, people are changing all the time. However, while nature and culture both change, the rate and scale of that change can vary enormously. However, the relationship between nature and culture is one of comparative dynamics, two entities that are constantly changing in relation to each other. So it follows that nature is neither timeless nor unchanging. It is not a harmonious utopia in counterpoint to a corrupt, unbalanced, unstable modern humanity. And it follows from that that ideas of nature, including the idea of nature as a harmonious, balanced utopia, are all socially constructed. They are all human ideas of nature, and they too change over time. All ideas of nature as a repository for sacred and eternal values are, of course, products of specific cultural histories, and there are many, many books on those specific cultural histories. It follows even further that gender is important. Men and women over time have experienced and shaped the natural world in very different ways, and they often define and construct ideas of nature in different ways. Technology, immensely important, as you all know, in shaping natural environments, but the effects of technology are powerfully mediated by the cultures in which they are embedded. It can be said for biological technologies like horses. It can be said for automobiles. It all depends on the culture in which they are embedded. Now, all of those codicils of environmental history sound pretty vague and pretty broad, I'm sure. So to get a bit more specific, I'll add a few more to the list and link them to the three broad sort of overarching stories and periods in American environmental history. There are, of course, many, many narratives and stories in this history, but these have emerged as sort of the dominant stories so far in the field. First, when people migrate from one ecosystem to another, they carry with them other organisms, plants, animals, microorganisms, whose success or failure in the new location is often crucial to the success or failure to the people who brought them, whether intentionally or unintentionally. The most powerful example we have of this, of course, is European contact with the New World and the initial conquest and settlement of the conquest of New World peoples and the settlement of North and South America. As historian Alfred Crosby and others have argued extensively, Europeans succeeded in colonizing the Neo-Europes, as he calls them, North and South America, Australia, New Zealand, because their animals, their plants, and their diseases thrived in those environments quite well. Euro-Americans thrived in North America in part because their diseases decimated Indian populations, their animals thrived and multiplied quickly, far beyond their own expectations, and their major food crops, wheat, oats, barley, grew almost everywhere they planted them, at least for a while. So the success of peoples is often linked to the success of their migrating organisms as well. Even within the story, however, you see complexity. I mentioned before this constant theme of unexpected consequences. Euro-American settlers in the Americas brought wheat and horses and pigs, but they also brought all kinds of weeds, which spread all over the place, pest species like rats, and all sorts of other problematic imports, a history which continues to this day, which you all read about. Their pigs took to the woods and went wild, trampling almost everything in sight, including their own gardens and their own crops, and then trampled the gardens and crops of native peoples, which made native peoples angry and hostile, for very good reason. And of course, Spanish horses, spreading north from Mexico, became the basis for a powerful transformation of Native American culture on the Great Plains, a transformation which led to ongoing military and cultural resistance to European conquest. So invading species worked both for and against Euro-Americans in ways they could never have predicted. Once again, unexpected consequences. Another central story. When people buy and sell things from nature in a market, they link together ecosystems and encourage change, rarely understanding the implications of what they are doing. The single most powerful story and the single most powerful factor in American environmental history has been the commodification of nature, its transformation into a thing traded for profit. This commodification continues to transform nature in North America. From the start, Euro-Americans looked at the abundance of North American environment and selected certain pieces of that natural world, land, timber, fish, beaver, deer, turned them into commodities, and bought and sold them in the marketplace. Along the way, they transformed forests and soils, eradicated animal species, changed the environment in ways they could not fully understand or anticipate. And of course, this commodification continues at all levels today to the commodification of every imaginable piece of nature, every imaginable idea of nature, right down to the ideas of nature that are bought and sold for recreation at Disney's Animal Kingdom and SeaWorld and all those places. The experience of nature commodified and sold in the market. Another central story, industrialization, as I mentioned before. People in industrialized, complex, consumer-based economies enjoy a full separation between the work of production and the work of consumption, while at the same time they create very complex ecological connections between places. The rise of mass production and mass consumption, this third great story, the rise of consumerism in the late 19th century and its vast expansion in the 20th century, physically divorced production and consumption in the American economy so that Americans in industrial cities, a story we all know well, consumed and continued to consume food and goods produced all over the country and all over the world, ate meals produced on distant factory farms, they no longer knew where their food came from. Yet they remained connected to nature through vastly complex economic and ecological networks, which made it almost impossible to recognize and to see their own connections to the natural world. Those connections easily disappeared from view and still remain quite invisible. And finally, Americans are divided and remain divided by class, by race, by power. So when these unexpected environmental consequences appear, they usually fall with greater weight on the less powerful. In almost every landscape and environment that historians study, poor and non-white Americans bear the brunt of the pollution and waste generated by industrial production and consumption. But they also bear the brunt of unintentional consequences of regulation and reform, of conservation, of the creation of national parks, of tourist economies and ecotourism, so that the unequal distribution of the burden of environmental change falls across the board on poor people in ways we could never have predicted or understood at the start. And finally, when Americans look to science for answers to environmental challenges, their culture and values shape the science itself and the policy based on that science. Scientific knowledge and practice cannot exist outside of culture. Human values, beliefs, expectations, relations of power, inequalities all shape the production and dissemination of scientific knowledge, which makes the science itself historically contingent and constantly changing. So if there is any final point I can offer as to the usefulness of what environmental history shows us, it is, perhaps not unexpectedly, an extraordinary reluctance on the part of Americans across the last few centuries to accept any sort of limits set by the environment. No matter how far the commodification goes, no matter how complex the economic and ecological achievements of human beings, they remain unable to escape some constraints imposed by non-human nature. After all, at Disney's Animal Kingdom, where you can buy and sell an experience of African nature in Florida, the Disney Corporation nonetheless faces the struggle every year of what to do with about 1,000 tons of animal manure. You can't always escape nature. And that leaves us with an enormous respect for the complexity and unpredictability of the natural world. And thus, the final lesson, if any, is that we must, as inheritors of this history, cultivate as much humility and attentiveness as humanly possible, which may be limited, and use that humility and attentiveness to remind ourselves daily that we can never really know what is going to happen next. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kathy. How many people here have editors? So when Kathy talks about contested meanings, you know exactly what she's talking about. Next, it's my pleasure to introduce James Howard Kunstler. And he's an author and a resident of New England. James Howard Kunstler has made a career of taking a hard look at societal decisions and implications that they have for people and the environment. He'll talk about a little bit about what lies ahead as the world struggles with dwindling oil supplies and an environment that's been altered by water shortages and a changing climate. I want to mention a couple of Jim's publications for you. One book is called The Long Emergency, and another, which I'm sure you're familiar with, is called A Geography of Nowhere. So please give Jim a warm welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. My last speaking gig was at a little Bible college in Georgia 2 days ago, and this is a very different audience. I'm going to try to keep this fairly simple, and I'm not going to offer you a disquisition on the technicalities of the global oil predicament, except to say that let's accept that as a given, that we are facing a global energy predicament. And it's for real. The quality of the conversation that we're having in our nation about this is very bad, very poor, and it tends to be full of delusional thinking, a lot of which tends to be self-reinforcing delusional thinking, feedback loops of delusional thinking. And we have to do a better job, and you are the transmitters around the nation of this public discussion. So the public discussion has to, beginning with you, has to become a better discussion. And, you know, for just for example, I think there were probably three media events last year that were very formative in this. One was the first 60 Minutes broadcast about Canadian tar sands and how they were going to save America for happy motoring. And after that, and that was broadcast to what? 20 million people, CBS 60 Minutes. Incredible, irresponsible journalism. Real stupidity. But it promoted the idea among Americans that we can continue to be a happy motoring society. They came back about 2 weeks later with a very similar parallel story to the effect that coal liquefaction would do the same thing, permit us to keep on happy motoring. And then CNN came on about 3 weeks after that with a major program saying that ethanol made from crops would save America for easy motoring. And then the nation went back to sleep again, you know, for about the seventh time since the original political Ambien took its grip on America in the form of Ronald Reagan. So we have to have a better discussion about this, and part of this is we cannot bring the assumptions of the pre-energy predicament to the reality of the post-energy predicament, and we're constantly doing that. For example, in the economics and financial media, we discuss things like housing starts in the most idiotic terms. You know, a lot of housing starts are good for us, and fewer housing starts are bad for us. And we need to really get into that story. I mean, among other things, the millions of housing starts that have occurred and largely on the land that is proximate to the existing cities is destroying whatever good agricultural land is left proximate to those cities, and we're going to need it desperately. So to not even make an inquiry into that story is a terrible failure. The whole idea about alternative fuels is extremely problematical. I would offer you, again, the given, the axiom, baseline understanding that I think we need to really get down and funky with, which is that no combination of alternative fuels or systems for running them is going to allow us to run Walt Disney World, Walmart, and the interstate highway system, or most of the other stuff that we're running. And we're going to probably do everything we can and use every kind of alternative fuel that we possibly can, but we're probably going to be disappointed about what they can do for us. We're probably not going to be doing wind power the way a lot of people, including journalists, assume that we're going to do it. The 400-unit farms of the Godzilla-sized towers, personally, I don't think we're going to do a whole heck of a lot of that. I think that what we're going to discover is that wind energy will be done on a very local basis and probably a household basis, and maybe not beyond that, we don't know. But the delusional thinking around alternative fuels is huge, and it is spurring, it is sending our whole nation in a very dangerous direction, and you cannot afford to promote that anymore. You really have to dig deeper. The main problem with all of this is that it has left us with one theme right now, and really for the last about 18 months, one single theme going through the American public. And that theme is, how are we going to keep running the cars by other means at all costs? And that's not enough of a public conversation, because we have to make other arrangements for a whole broad list of categories of things for how we're going to carry on some kind of civilization. It cannot just be about how we're going to run the cars. You know, and that's why I view people like Amory Lovins as being very pernicious agents in this discussion. And Amory who's not a bad human being, I think is doing a real disservice to the Western world by promoting the idea that supercars or hypercars or cars that will get supernaturally wonderful mileage are a benefit to us. Because the real unintended consequence, as Catherine said, of that is that it promotes the idea that we can continue to be a car-dependent society. And nothing could be a greater act of futility than to pursue those ideas. You know, if Amory had spent 1/50th of the energy that his institution is spending and put 1/50th of the institutional muscle behind the idea of something like walkable communities instead of supercars and hypercars, we would all be much, much better off. And the environmental journalists would not be conducting a stupid dialogue about what we're going to do. The leadership that we're getting around the country in every field is very poor. It's very poor in politics, obviously, and in both realms of the spectrum. And we have to do better. The Democrats, actually, we're sort of right now, you know, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes.
Yeah.
We're replaying the 1850s now with the loss of legitimacy of the major parties due to their laziness, intransigence, and cowardice. And we don't know where they're going to go. Business, obviously, the leadership is very poor. In fact, it's downright venal and possibly evil. In education, the leadership is cowardly. And in the environmental movement, I'm not sure how to categorize it. I'll leave that to you. I saw an example of the business leadership about a year ago. I was invited to the Google headquarters to give a talk about energy. And it was very instructive. I went into the Google headquarters in Silicon Valley in an office park structure, and the whole inside of it was tricked out like a kindergarten. They had games everywhere. They had foosball and pool tables and ping pong and video consoles, and they had the Lucite boxes full of gummy bears and the yogurt pretzels, because you can never be more than 12 inches away from your sugary snack noodle. And then the executives came in to the auditorium, and these were young people who had made millions of dollars working for Google. You know, 26-year-old people who had gotten in 5 years ago and were paid partly in stock or stock options and had made millions of dollars. And when they came into the auditorium, and by the way, this is the highest level of American corporate high-tech enterprise, right? They come into the auditorium, they are dressed like skateboard rats. Executives wearing sideways hats, and you can see their ass crack as they turn around to talk to their friends. And I think this is the highest level of corporate governance in America. And after my talk, we had questions and comments, and there were no questions, just comments, and it was all the same comment. So, like, dude, we've got technology. But I began to understand where they were coming from, and I think this is as simple as this. You know, you get a lot of very young people who are supernaturally successful in making money when they're young by moving pixels around the screen with a mouse, and they develop very grandiose ideas of what technology can do for us. And by the way, no consciousness whatsoever of the blowback, of the diminishing returns, of the unexpected consequences. You know, no idea of what that's all about. And they're going to be very disappointed. They're going to find out, for example, that the commercial airline fleets of the world are either going to run on liquid hydrocarbon fuels, or we're not going to have them. We're not going to have commercial airlines, because guess what? We're not going to change out all the equipment. Certainly not soon enough to avoid problems. We're not going to change out the Boeing 737s, 47s, 57s, and all airline fleets of the world. It isn't going to happen. So we have to start really examining the idea. The environmental journalists have to start examining the idea that technology and energy are not the same thing, and they're not substitutable. And if you run out of one, you can't just plug in the other and keep Walt Disney World and Walmart going. Because that's where our thinking is at, and that's not good enough. And I heard the same thing at Middlebury College about 18 months ago. I gave a talk there, and the biodiesel youth of America was very unhappy with what I had to say about, you know, I basically suggested they were going to be disappointed. And, you know, they're young, they don't know that much, so, you know, I'll give them that much. And they have enthusiasm, which is good. But, you know, we talked about this after my blab, and you know, I asked them, you know, they're really, you know, ethanol, biodiesel, dude, we can run our Chevy Tahoes on that and go skiing. They could probably run the ski areas on it, too. And we talked about it. I said, you know, are you aware that as we enter this period of fossil fuel scarcity and trouble with fossil fuels, that we're going to have less soil amendments to put on the ground to produce all the corn and all the soybeans, and you know, the crop yields are going to go way down. It's not going to be a matter of just assigning a million, X million number of bushels of corn previously allocated for cheese doodles now going towards the Chevy Tahoe. You're going to be disappointed. It's probably not going to work out that way. And they're like, oh, dude. Came as a complete shock to them. Why? Because they hadn't been informed by the environmental press that this is fucking nonsense. That's why. Because they hadn't been informed that what we're talking about is the Adirondack blanket trick, where the guy wants to make his blanket longer, so he cuts a foot off at the top and sews it onto the bottom. And that's what we're dealing with. Only it's worse than that, because what's happening is, in the cutting and the hemming and the stitching, you're actually losing 4 inches. So you're cutting a foot off the top and sewing 8 inches back on the bottom. You know, and we have to get more real about this. The bottom line, how much time do I have?
8 minutes.
Okay, the bottom line about this is we have to make other arrangements for a lot of things, not just the cars. We're going to have to make other arrangements for how we grow our food. And we're going to have to grow it more locally, closer to where we live. Some parts of the country are not going to make it. You know, Phoenix is not going to make it. In Las Vegas, the excitement will be over. And that will be a very good thing for us. Because Las Vegas and the mentality behind it is behind a lot of the delusional thinking that we're seeing. And the idea behind Las Vegas is very simple. Las Vegas is the holy shrine to America's most important religion. It's not evangelical Christianity. And by the way, they don't object to Las Vegas. Have you noticed? I was down in the Bible about 2 days ago and I asked them about that. And they're like, oh, we hadn't thought about it, really. The holy shrine in Las Vegas is the shrine to the worship of unearned riches. The worship of unearned riches. Based on the idea that it's possible to get something for nothing. And that's what a lot of the alternative fuel discussion is about. And we have to get much more serious. And by the way, my touchstone for seriousness in our culture right now is the fact that we're having no discussion at all about fixing up the passenger railroad system, which is the one thing we could do right away that would have a huge impact on our oil use, that would create hundreds of thousands of meaningful jobs, that would benefit people of all ranks of society, and would give us the confidence in a group effort to go on and do the other tasks that we have to fix. We have to rebuild the agriculture system. That's going to be very messy process, because it's going to involve a lot of loss of hallucinated value in land values and the reassignment of land use, which is going to cause enormous struggles. We're going to have to rebuild local networks of economic interdependency, in other words, shopping, commerce, trade, because Walmart and all of its similar national chain models for commerce are going to fail. They're going to fail. The 12,000-mile supply line for household goods, the warehouse on wheels, all those parts of the equation are going to fail in an energy-scarce future. How are we going to rebuild local networks of economic interdependency? You guys got to write about that, because we don't have a clue how we're going to start doing that. We're probably going to have to reform education severely. Because the centralized secondary schools all over America are going to fail. We're not going to be able to bus all the children around in the yellow umbilicus of the school bus system. And we have no idea how we're going to face these problems. the whole question of how we inhabit the landscape, how we inhabit the terrain of North America is going to change. And of course, this involves the biggest problem of all, which is the fact that we have poured our national wealth of the last half century into constructing an infrastructure for daily life with no future. And that's everything to the east of where we're sitting right now. Williston, suburbia, the big box pads, the strip malls, the housing subdivisions, all of that stuff is going to lose value severely, both monetary value and practical value. And the problem with that, and I describe it, you know, customarily, as the greatest misallocation of resources in the history of the world, because it has no future. In an energy-scarce future, it's going to lose its value. And the biggest problem with that is that it entails a powerful psychology of previous investment, which prevents us from even entertaining the idea that we might have to let go of it, or walk away from it, or change it, or fix it. And we're probably not going to be able to fix most of it. That's an additional layer of problems. An additional layer of problems from the journalistic point of view, which nobody is talking about, is the fact that insidiously, the building of ever more suburban crap, which is to say the building of ever more of an infrastructure for daily life with no future, has become the basis of our economy. Which is why the housing bubble bursting would be such a catastrophe for us. Because it means that we could not base our economy anymore on building more strip malls and selling more subdivisions. And we've managed to maintain this by really, by undermining, perverting, and almost destroying the capital lending system by incredible irresponsibility in lending and banking practices and finance. And that's an enormous story that's waiting out there to be told and put together and knitted together with this greater environmental story of how we're going to survive the end of the cheap energy age. So with that, I'll leave you with one other thought, which I like to leave with student audiences because they're in some ways a little more psychologically fragile, and you guys are all adults, but in case anybody asks me, you know, the kids always say, "Can't you give me any hope?" You know, and it reminds me of going to a conference of the future of the American city at Yale in like 1994. And this is in academia, of course, the heart of darkness of academia. And all the people in this Yale conference are getting up one after another in order to blow smoke up each other's asses, saying, "We must give self-esteem to the poor people in the cities." You know, and it was my turn, and I said, "We must give cocaine to all the poor people in the cities. Because it makes you feel great about yourself without accomplishing anything." And the fact of the matter is, if you want hope, and nobody can give you hope any more than anyone can give you self-esteem. But we have to inform the people of this country, especially the young people, that they're the generators of the hope. And that they can generate their own hope by demonstrating that they're capable people, that they're capable of apprehending and dealing with the new circumstances that the world is sending to them. And you have to be the transmitters to get those messages out, to help them be competent and help them be sane, which is to say, non-delusional. And so with that, I guess I'll leave it now. Thank you.
And we've got time for questions. We've got a microphone here in the front. So if anybody has anything, comments, questions.
By the way, as a historian, I can say with absolute certainty that the 1850s did not end well.
No, that's very true. It ended in a convulsion, and it's something we ought to be conscious of.
So the 1850s are the ass crack of the 19th century.
Well, it's a dark interval.
Jim.
Jim Norvali, Magazine. I wanted to ask James Comser, I think I know the answer, but I'm going to ask it anyway, or ask him to comment on the idea of the hydrogen energy economy and the future of it.
Well, it was one of those enthusiasms that had a life of about 15 minutes, and the president announced it with great fanfare in 2002, and then everybody took a look at the nature of hydrogen and said, well, next. They said, check the no box on that. Because, you know, why? Because it ain't going to happen. You know, there are again, it's one of those things that we will be disappointed by. There are things you can do with hydrogen, but I think that the application of it will prove to be very limited because of the nature of hydrogen and the difficulty of managing it, transporting it, storing it, the economics of creating it, etc. It's basically a loser idea when you're talking about running the crap that we're running now on it. You know, that's the problem, is getting Americans off of this monomania that the whole idea is to keep Walmart and Walt Disney World going, because we're going to have to make other arrangements for a living that will not include those things.
Hi, my name is Bill Hodges. I'm a student at San Francisco University of California. First, you know, as a student, I want to say that it's a little bit ageist to be looking at the youth and asking us for solutions. Because really, for myself, I'm looking to my elders. And historically, right, much of society looked to their elders for resolution of their problems. And I would really argue that you guys have failed.
Well, I'm sorry. On behalf of the boomer generation, I apologize. I would say this, though. I don't think it helps to use terms like ageist. You know, we're now entering such, we've developed such a nomenclature of blame shifting that it's there's no point to that anymore, you know.
Hi, I'm Mark Pendergrass. I'm also a baby boomer. I apologize for that, too. About 20 or 30 years ago, there was, you know, everybody was interested in methane gas from manure and stuff. And I still think that seems like a good idea from various degradations of the stuff we produce. And I also like you to talk a little bit more about what you think our rail system should be doing. I mean, Europe has a wonderful rail system, but it still uses forms of energy that are going to become obsolete, aren't they?
Is that for me or Catherine?
That's for both of you.
I'm going to be real short with this and then turn it over to Catherine. The first thing, you know, making methane from manure. As I said, I'm in favor of us investigating and getting down with all of these alternative fuel things, but I just warn you, they're probably not going to do the thing quite what you expect. Yeah, you can make methane from cow shit and other stuff, but can you? Once again, it's really, the issue is scale. This all comes down to scale. You can run cars on all kinds of things. You can make fuel cell cars right now. Can we make 250 million of them? Forget about it. Can we run 250 million cars on methane from cow shit or French fried potato oil or any of those things? Forget about it. You can run 10,000 of them on, or maybe 25,000 or whatever. But its scale is the issue here, and the whole thing implies that we're going to have to contrive other systems. And luckily, you know, we have some clues that there are other systems that we can do. The railroad system, by the way, we have a railroad system that the Bolivians would be ashamed of. And you know, among the delusions that we're hearing around the country is that we should do maglev. You know, we should do very high-tech railroads. We have to demonstrate that we can do railroads on the Romanian level first before we get promoted up to maglev. So I vote that let's do the best we can with the early 20th century technology that's waiting out there rusting in the rain before we attempt to, you know, have a space program with rail.
Clint Wilder with CleanEdge.com. Question for Jim. If you could just expand on your comments about wind farms and, you know, what the limitations are. Is it the scale issue? Is it opposition? And I want to point out, in Germany, they've got significant percentages of their energy from wind and solar. And we can talk about solar as well and your prospects there.
Yeah. I think we are going to try to use as much of this stuff as we can. I just think we're probably not going to be able to carry it that far. One thing is that we're starting very, very late compared to these other countries that have been thinking about it and doing it. Another thing, which is, you know, a little bit further off, is the idea of whether we can even fabricate the hardware to do this kind of activity without an underlying fossil fuel economy. And I don't see that the enthusiasts have thought that out very well. There's, again, they're bringing the pre-energy scarcity assumptions to the post-energy scarcity world, and I wouldn't assume that it's going to be easy to fabricate, you know, these things using advanced metallurgy and all the really very sophisticated procedures necessary. And again, it's a matter of scale. You can say categorically, I think, that virtually everything we do is going to have to be scaled down. Whether, you know, that anything that is organized at the giant scale, whether it's electric power generation or government or a corporation or the University of Vermont, anything scaled really large is going to probably falter and probably fail in this kind of coming economy. So our expectations, I think, have to be appropriate, and we have to consider doing everything on a more modest scale. So again, you know, it's a matter of expecting to run all of our stuff the way it's now in place, and the unwillingness to let go of our current system.
Nancy Basilchuk, freelance journalist, former conference chair.
Not yet.
Oh, right. This is actually a question for both of you. As I said to Jim, I've read his book and had to make my husband read it immediately so I had somebody to talk to about it. But as I read your book, I found myself thinking that we as a society, not just American society, but society at large, has had to make several major shifts throughout history from horses to motorized vehicles, from coal to oil. I mean, we have made these what in might at the time have seemed to be cataclysmic shifts in the past, and you know, you and I are still talking here, riding on the fossil fuel wave. So my question for you guys is, can we not be, do we have to really be gloom and doom? We've done it before as a society, and so why can't we do it again?
So you both can take it.
Well, again, historians can only talk about the past. And yes, there have been powerful transformations between sources of energy before, from wind and wood to fossil fuels. And I think only now are historians really thinking about going back and carefully examining exactly what sort of rhetoric and culture and political power went into making those shifts. But we know for sure that at a time it all seemed like an excellent idea, that moving from horses to horseless carriages powered by steam and then by coal, by wood steam and then by coal steam, seemed a liberation from nature and a transformation that was all good all the time for most people. So we know that it was embraced as progress and as the foundation of the American economy in a pretty much entirely good way. And now, unexpectedly, it turns out we're going to destroy the planet with it. So only now, I think, can we begin to go back to the past and try and figure out what was going through people's heads. But also, to return to the question of railroads, I mean, we were also journalists and historians together, finally going back and in great detail writing the history of the auto industry in this country, which is one of nefariousness writ so large that we have only begun to grasp the scale of that nefariousness, that there are, not to sound like a conspiracy theorist, powerful forces arrayed and have been for a very 100 years arrayed against the use of railroads in this country, very powerful forces. We have, as James has brilliantly written, a vast infrastructure, an economic system, largely supported by the need to drive and fuel cars, and for any economy or economic interest group to take on that power will be, of course, a vastly revolutionary political and economic move. It now seems like we're at the point with the big three sort of going down in flames, where it might start to happen, but there are powerful forces arrayed against it. And they've been doing some pretty interesting stuff for some very long time, and we're only beginning to get the story. So I think it will be hard. But I'm not without hope that, you know, we could take them all out in a few decades.
Well, I think that the hope that we will go through another epochal upward transformation to yet higher and better standards of living is an understandable hope. But I do think that we may be making a mistake in thinking that this is a perpetual, unending serial, when in fact, to some extent, it's going to be a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. You know, one of the things that, one of the unforeseen consequences of our industrial culture, which has destroyed a lot of things, including a lot of mental infrastructure, is the idea that life is tragic. Life is tragic, and history doesn't care whether we succeed or fail. And history doesn't offer any entitlements to special, exceptional groups of people to keep on inventing cool new things to save themselves. I don't consider myself a gloomer or doomer. All I think is that we're going to enter a period of falling back a bit. One of the things, obviously, we haven't talked about here today is the population. And people often ask me about that, you know. And the answer is, we're not going to do a damn thing about it. You know, the usual culprits will come into play. You know, war and starvation and disease and, you know, the things we've been familiar with. We're not going to do anything about it. There's no protocol that's going to allow us to continue to do this. And I think we're well aware of the environmental destruction that we're causing, which threatens all life on the planet. So the fantasy, where's the person who asked the question?
Nancy.
Oh, right, Nancy. You know, this is part of the fantasy that it's the part of the Faustian fantasy that human ingenuity is boundless, and that there's no question that in 13 years some rescue remedy will be found in the form of, you know, a miracle fuel or dark matter or harnessing fusion, you know, one of these wishful things. And in fact, it may be simply a matter of readopting some traditional ways of doing things and keeping some of the stuff that we're able to keep. One of the most, I think one of the biggest questions is how we're going to preserve a lot of the knowledge that we've acquired for all kinds of things. So I just wouldn't assume that there's a moment out there that's going to be the rescue remedy moment.
Darn.
and well, I'm sorry I'm going on so much about this. So I want to say one more thing about this. That another assumption that has been a baseline assumption in the environmental press is that this is necessarily going to be an orderly transition. And I think you ought to challenge that assumption if you have it, because it's probably going to be very turbulent.
Krista George from Oregon Public Broadcasting, and I read your book and interviewed you earlier this year. I've been, for those of you who haven't, it's going to be a long 9 months digesting this concept. But I have talked to people about the idea that there's no energy source like fossil fuel that will give us more out of it than goes into it. And people have come back with a couple of things that I wanted to run by you, and then a question for Catherine too. Nukes is the one that comes up the most. The other is hot rock technology, which I'm assuming has got some big unintended consequences if we all drill down into the core of the Earth. And my question for Catherine that will follow this is, if we go to the sort of small-scale village world, back to that, can you give us an optimistic, from history, way that we can marry our better technology with that small-scale life?
Well, you go on the energy first, while I think.
What was the first energy?
Nukes.
Well, nukes are very dangerous, and the byproducts of them can, in some cases, last longer than the projected life of the Earth. I think that we had better have a public discussion about what we're going to do with it, because the likelihood is we'll get to a certain point 3 or 4 years out from now where we'll all turn around and say, oh my God, there's nothing else but nukes. We better start building more. And we're not having any public discussion about that any more than we're having a public discussion about public transit. So we better start it. The temptation will be that there's no other way to keep the lights on.
So I guess that question is, if we, historians don't talk about the future, don't predict the future. But if we were to try to imagine a utopian future of small town American life with relocalized economies, local food production, no one ever goes very far, no one ever travels very fast, and then strangely try and project that into the past and try and find it, I think we fall into a usual and quite normal attempt to find a utopian past, to find some perfect small town American world that existed in some mythic Midwestern place many years ago and became the subject of musical theater and and plays set in Vermont. And I think what we have to realize is the past is a foreign country. If we came up with the time machine that would allow us to go to that place, to small town America with a local economy, we would find all kinds of things we would not find acceptable. Inequality, racism, disease.
Cruelty to animals.
Women in very small cabins having 12 children, this is a book I taught this week, in Kansas going pretty much insane from living in Kansas in a small cabin, growing food locally. I mean, I think that that past doesn't exist. However, I think that imagining a future with more local economies is something that a lot of people are very energetically and hopefully doing and have been for decades. The entire 19th century was devoted to creating an economy of scale and a non-local economy so that the best possible world was with one in which your food was produced as cheaply as possible from as far away as possible and transported to you as cheaply as possible from as far away as possible. And that was the goal of that economy. And it created an incredibly powerful economic system that generated a tremendous amount of wealth. And it's fascinating that now, 100 years later, we decided that almost every one of those decisions was wrong. But it did, of course, create a standard of living we've become a bit attached to. But there's no reason that some of that won't be disassembled and that we will find ourselves living from the earth in more local ways. Many of us already are trying to do that. But it raises all kinds of complicated questions, like how do you function as a upper middle class intellectual who flies to conferences if you're trying to live locally? How do you teach at a liberal arts college where the goal is to bring the students from as far as possible 4 times a year? That our entire world is built on rapid transportation and massive command of resources at great distance. So it would be hard to give that up to live, on the Great Plains in the 1890s. And I don't think any of us would willingly do it.
We'll take two more folks in line, and then we'll take a break. So, Saul, do you want to go ahead?
Dale.
Three more folks.
And I should mention the 21st Century Fund, because nobody has for 10 minutes, so I just threw it out. Jim, I want to raise something that you and I have fought over in the kitchen before, and I'm surprised you didn't bring up more here. You've talked a great deal about the need for paradigmatic shifts in thinking in so many ways. But the challenge to the journalists is write different stories. Is that all it's going to take, or do you see a need for a pretty major paradigm shift in the journalism world as well to begin to address the problems that you see up there?
No, I don't think it requires any kind of a momentous shift in the journalism world. We're just doing a lousy job. It's hard to imagine the kind of laziness, intellectual laziness, that went into those 60 Minutes broadcasts and the amount of damage that they did to the collective public imagination. I don't think it's necessarily a You know, I'm allergic to conspiracy theories too. I don't believe that the executives of the major media are sitting there wringing their hands, thinking, "How can we screw the American people?" You know, what we have is a flimsy, poorly constructed consensus that is partly assembled out of ideas that are untrue. And it's your job to start sorting out between the stuff that's true and the stuff that's not true. And I just don't think that it takes a supernatural effort. And delusional thinking, I'm very interested in the whole question of why a public consensus can fail. And that's what we're really seeing. It's a collective problem, and we're all in some way contributing to it. But what I'm suggesting is that you have to perhaps do the same thing that George Bush is thinking about doing in Iraq, is pulling back a little and wondering whether your tactics and strategy are working, and evaluate them, because I don't think they are working. I think the American public is poorly informed about ethical problems that they face, and that they're not getting enough news about.
Real quickly, we've got time for two quick questions.
I get sort of get the feeling sometimes, as a bit of an emerging environmental writer, having in my past, but having abandoned it for a while and trying to get back into it, that the easiest way to sell a story is to sell it through sort of an existing business or status quo paradigm. And I sort of get the feeling that we're going to have to pry it from their cold, dead hands, in the sense that sort of tell the sort of the next story, if you will. What kind of paradigm shift do you see happening in the way the newsroom is structured?
I want to talk about this. I really want to mention a couple of things about this, especially the New York Times, which I think has done an unbelievably terrible job of covering the energy story. You know, there are two stories in particular that come to mind. One was Paul Berman's review of Francis Fukuyama's book on the front page of the book review. And it was a long, 4,000-word essay about Francis Fukuyama was giving up on conservative politics because they had screwed up so badly in Iran, and it was all about that. And Paul Berman is a very good writer on the subject of terrorism. The word oil was never mentioned in the story. There was nothing about what are our strategic interests in the Middle East, and that's a big part of the story. But to not ask the question, for the editors to not ask the question, the same thing with Peter Moss's story about. Basically, it was their peak oil is for real story about 14 months ago, August of 2005. And Peter Moss wrote this long story, a large part of which was rehashed stuff that had been on the internet for 12 months. But he did actually interview a couple of Saudi, former retired Saudi oil ministers, who basically gave a different story than the party line in Saudi Arabia. And their story was, we're in trouble here with our reserves. And then, I heard him interviewed by Terry Gross the next day on Fresh Air. And she said, "Well, Peter, what can we do?" And it was his answer. "Well, we can develop cars to get better mileage." What kind of a failure of imagination is that? We got to take it well beyond that. So, we're getting the stories are finding their way into the press. But the editorial command of what's at stake is kind of infantile, and I don't know how to pamphlet. Maybe people are too busy. It may be one of the unintentional consequences of the information revolution that we're drowning in so much information we can't make sense out of it. But we got to do a better job. The New York Times got to do a better job, and they're the they speak with authority, and they, like a lot of other institutions in our life, are losing legitimacy because of the poor job that they're doing. And we can't afford to have every institution in our culture lose legitimacy at the same time. Then you end up with a situation like after World War I, where Western civilization starts to lose legitimacy and you get into a real problem.
One final question.
I'm Margaret Roosevelt. I write for Time magazine. I'm based in L.A. California beats its chest about being the most environmentally conscious state. We've just passed all these laws on CO2 in cars and CO2 in factories, etc. But we're about to re-elect Arnold Schwarzenegger, who owns six Hummers, or maybe it's eight Hummers. I'm fascinated by the disconnect between the abstract, what people know to be true and think to be true, and yet their personal lifestyles, how they change their own personal behavior, and whether change is going to come, you know, has to come through a change in mentality, and that goes for every single person in the U.S. Jim, you own a car, you live in a small, tiny apartment in the middle of New York, or just tell us a little bit about it. You have so much passion for this vision you have of the abstract, all the dreadful things that are going to happen. We all need to think, I guess, about how we are behaving in our own society. How do you change your own lifestyle to deal with your beliefs?
Well, living in a 34-room house in Westchester County with 11 saunas, I don't think about that. No, I made my decision about 30 years ago, and I moved to, I don't live in New York City, I moved to a classic Main Street town in upstate New York, and I've been living in and around it ever since. Right now I'm living in a rental a mile and a half outside of town in a place where I can have a garden. I don't commute, otherwise, to some degree, I'm left within the constraints of the infrastructure of daily life in America. I had to drive up here because we don't have a railroad system that allows me to get up here by any other way. I want to say something though about the California life and it's not California, it's really the mentality in general of the upper classes in America. You know, we've been bombarded with so much propaganda, incessant broadcast advertising, and Walt Disney and Spielberg movies for so long that that in itself is making it very difficult for us to tell the difference between what is real and what is not, what comports with reality and what does not comport with reality. So one of the projects that I recommend for America, if we really want a rescue remedy, is to find some way to harness the energy from all the smoke we're blowing up our ass.
Kathy, you want to follow that?
Sure. In terms of personal environmental choices, I do the best I can. But I think that since about 1980, the powers that be, conspiracy theory again, has managed to do a remarkable job of shifting the central questions with regard to the Earth's future from a demand for effective political leadership, from a close examination of the role of corporate America in getting us into this mess to begin with, shift from the big questions to forcing each of us to spend 2 hours a day in painful soul-searching about whether we should drive to the supermarket or not, or drive to take our dogs for a walk, which is my big paradox, to burn fossil fuel to walk. So to constantly focus on the question of personal consumer choices gets us very, which are important questions, very, very tied up in knots that lead largely nowhere, because the scale of personal tiny changes will not save the Earth at this point. I think that much is clear. And that to attack people for the personal choices they make about how they get through their lives, and Arnold Schwarzenegger or not, he can't drive six cars at once, is to miss the big picture, which there are people we need to ask much harder questions of than perhaps ourselves. And also there are very, very deep historical roots in American environmentalism of this sort of Puritan self-denial thing where that you achieve virtue through ascetic self-denial, and that the less you consume and the less you actually take from the earth, the purer you are and the closer you'll get to God. And a lot of this is an attempt at personal purity, which has deep religious roots and is very respectable, but again, it's has deep historical roots, and I don't think it'll profoundly shape the future. Self-denial, no matter how much fun, may not get us anywhere on a personal level.
Let's thank our panelists. Nancy has a couple of announcements, and then we'll take a short break and convene back here.
Yeah, sure.